Welcome to the Penguin Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Penguin Podcast, where we'll be exploring how we remember information, things that have happened, and even poetry through memory. Debut writer Emma Healy has put memory, or more specifically, losing one's memory, at the centre of her brilliant novel Elizabeth is Missing. The lead character, Maud, has been getting forgetful and writes notes to remind herself of things, but when she finds a note in her pocket, in her own handwriting, that reads, "Elizabeth is missing," she begins an investigation into the disappearance of her friend. But how do you solve a mystery when you can't remember the clues? Here's Emma Healy reading the introduction of the book, which introduces Maud and her friend Elizabeth.
Maud, was I boring you so much that you'd rather stand outside in the dark? A woman calls to me from the warm light of a cluttered dining room. My breath curls towards her, wet and ghostly, but no words follow. The snow, sparse but bright on the ground, reflects the light onto her face, which is drawn tight in an attempt to see. I know, though, that she can't see very well, even in the daylight. "Come inside," she says. "It's freezing. I promise I won't say another word about frogs and snails and majolica ware." "I wasn't bored," I say, realising too late that she's joking. "I'll be there in a minute. I'm just looking for something." In my hand is a thing I've already found, still clotted with mud. A small thing, easily missed. The broken lid of an old compact. Its silver tarnished, its navy blue enamel no longer glassy but scratched and dull. The mildewed mirror is like a window on a faded world, like a porthole looking out under the ocean. It makes me squirm with memories. "What have you lost?" The woman steps, precarious and trembling, out onto the patio. "Can I help? I might not be able to see it, but I can probably manage to trip over it if it's not too well hidden." I smile, but I don't move from the grass. Snow has collected on the ridges of a shoe print, and it looks like a tiny dinosaur fossil freshly uncovered. I clutch at the combat lid in my hand, soil tightening my skin as it dries. I've missed this tiny thing for nearly 70 years. And now the earth, made sludgy and chewable with the melting snow, has spat out a relic, spat it into my hand. But where from? That's what I can't discover. Where did it lie before it became the gristle in the earth's meal? An ancient noise, like a fox bark, makes an attempt at the edges of my brain. "Elizabeth," I ask, "did you ever grow marrows?"
Emma Healy, reading an extract from her debut novel, Elizabeth is Missing, which is out now. From remembering recent events to the distant past. Around the 5th century BC, Herodotus created the first great masterpiece of non-fiction writing in The Histories, which narrates the Persian invasions of Greece and describes the world of ancient Greece. Without historians such as Herodotus, who transcribe their contemporary memories, our understanding of the ancient world would be lost. And thanks to gifted translators like Tom Holland, modern readers can now fully appreciate the drama and mystery of this great book. Here he is, reading an extract from his recent translation of The Histories.
So, what the Scythians do is to take the seeds of a cannabis plant, crawl in under the blankets, and cast the seeds onto the glowing stones. As they hit the stones, the seeds flare as though they were incense, and emit a vapour so thick that no steam bath in Greece could possibly compete with it. The effect of this vapour on the Scythians is to make them howl with delight. It also serves them as the equivalent of a bath, since they never use water to wash themselves. That said, their women do blend water with a mixture of cypress, cedar and frankincense wood, which is pounded by them with a rough stone until a thick paste is formed, whereupon they plaster the paste all over their bodies and faces. Not only does this endow them with a delicious scent, but when they remove the plaster one day later, it leaves them cleansed and gleaming. So two of Xerxes' brothers fell in the battle, which raged furiously over the corpse of Leonidas, Persian against Lacedaemonian, until by sheer force of courage, the Greeks managed to grab hold of the body and send their adversaries reeling back 4 times. This contest continued until the soldiers arrived with Ephialtes, at which point, as the Greeks became aware of their coming, the whole character of the fighting changed. The Greeks withdrew back past the wall to where the road was narrow, and there, all of them except for the Thebans, banded together and took up a position on a hillock. On this hillock, which was located in the entrance to the pass, where the stone lion commemorating Leonidas now stands, They defended themselves with daggers, if they still had them, or else with their fists and teeth. Meanwhile, the barbarians buried them beneath a hail of missiles, pulling down the defensive wall and attacking them head-on, with those who had come round the mountain completing the encirclement.
A reading from The Histories by Tom Holland, whose translation of Herodotus's epic history is available now. You're listening to the Penguin Podcast. Music and memory form two core elements in the new novel from Colm Tabin, Nora Webster. It's set in Enniscorthy in Southern Ireland in 1967 and tells the story of a woman coming to terms with her recent widowhood. It's told in the third person and it's a work of fiction, but it's set in Colm's hometown at the time of his own youth and is told with such precise and clear detail, external and internal, that it feels almost like a displaced memoir. Colm came to the podcast studio to talk about the book, and I asked him about just how closely the story relates to his own childhood.
I changed quite a lot, but the contours are the same. In other words, the years are the same, the house is the same, and some of those things happened. As a memoir, it wouldn't have worked because it would have been from my point of view, and it simply would not have been rich enough. I would not have been able to get enough from what I was noticing and seeing and even remembering. It had to move out to be from someone else's life. And it had to also have the freedom that if something didn't fit the novel, it would be either removed or something new would be created for the book. So so it's a mixture. And so it will puzzle people who know the town or who know the family, because they'll think, well, some of this is true, but some of this isn't. And that's what the freedom of the novel is, really, to sort of work with that.
But you were also, it seemed to me reading it, you were dealing with exactly that combination both of your memory and of a fictional character dealing with a fictional circumstance. And it was the way you melded those two. How powerful is your sense of recollection? How immediate is your recall of those years for you? And how were you then able to bring them into the story?
My memory is perfect. Really perfect. I wonder if that's got something to do with the actual experience itself of being 12 and suddenly something new happens in the house where my father's dead and a sort of set of new circumstances arise. But I'm not sure about that. But my memory is perfect. So I could work from that, erasing, adding, using things, constantly sort of navigating as though, well, will this be any use? And if it wasn't from life, then I would make it up, including indeed some characters and some places, including, for example, where she works.
Did you at any point rethink those memories? You said your memory was perfect, but as you were working with them, changing this, changing that, did the memories themselves change?
No.
Did your sense of the actuality of those events change at all?
No, nothing.
Absolutely sad.
Nothing. No. There's no real discovery in it. I mean, the job is more or less to do the book, but you don't really find out anything from doing it. It's work. It's not anything else, really, very much.
Colm Tabin talking about his book Nora Webster, from which we can now hear an audiobook extract read by Fiona Shaw, reflecting on some of the things that Colm has just been relaying about memories of his mother.
She found the chair across the room. The clothes that had been on it had been put away somewhere. She hoped that her staying here would not cause her sisters or the neighbours to feel that it was because of remorse or the need to make up to her mother, to show regret for what she might have done or what she had not done in the past. She did not feel remorse. Instead, as she looked at her mother's dead face, she felt a closeness to her, a connection that she had in some way always felt, but never acted on or spoken about. The face, cleared of suffering and of familiar expression, resembled her mother in old photographs when she had a thin, dark, shy, watchful beauty. That, or traces of it, had returned. Her mother would have liked the idea that her youth, or some part of it, had come back. Her two sisters came and looked at their dead mother. Catherine knelt and bowed in prayer and blessed herself as she rose to her feet. Nora watched her as she self-consciously stood by the bed in the role of prayerful, sorrowing daughter. She wished that Catherine would go downstairs. When she caught her sister's eye for a moment, she found an expression there that she did not trust, and she determined that no matter what happened over the time that followed, she would not find herself alone with Catherine. She would stay here in the room all night if she had to. She would not leave the chair. When Morris arrived to be with her, she told him that she was going to stay the night here in the room. He held her hand for a moment and then said he would bring the children in the morning, but he would go home now and stay with them. She smiled at him as he left. Her mother had loved Morris. That was not unusual, Nora thought, as everyone loved Morris. Over the next few hours, neighbours came. They each knelt down and said a prayer. A few leaned in to touch the dead woman's hands with rosy beads entwined or her forehead. They nodded at Nora, and a few whispered to her about how peaceful her mother looked, or how she had gone to a better place, or how she would be missed. When Nora was alone in the room, she could hear voices downstairs, and she guessed that people were having tea and sandwiches. The candles had burned down to half their size. Her mother was nothing now, except an old woman who had died. There were no features on her face that Nora could make out, just whitened, wrinkled skin, and a chin that was still oddly noticeable. Without her eyes open, without her voice speaking, her mother was nobody. There was no life in her. Eventually the house became quiet. Una came and offered to stay instead of her, but Nora refused, and she suggested that her two sisters try to get some sleep. She would make sure that there were candles kept burning and that her mother was not alone on her last night in the world. There was silence in the house, broken sometimes by the passing of cars and by the rattling of the windows in the bedroom in the night wind. Nora wondered if it was the tiredness or the light from the candles that cast long shadows on the wall, but she would not have been surprised if her mother had moved now or spoken. The talk between them might have been easy. What was strange, as she began to look at her mother again, was how little she was sure of. The details of her mother's face had vanished, but there was an expression still, a sense of someone. And then that sense became more exact, more clear the more she watched. She could see other people in her mother's face, the faces of cousins, the Holdens and the Murphys, and the Baileys and the Kavanaghs, the faces of Catherine and Una, Nora's own face, the faces of Nora's children, especially Fiona. It was as though her mother, in this long night alone, became all of them. All the natural life had gone, and instead something else had come, something a long time in the making. It lingered there, and then it faded, and something else replaced it. The face exuded an impression more powerful than anything it had ever done in the days and nights when there was breath and voice. Nora was not sure. She tried to picture her mother as she remembered her best, an old woman in a grey coat of soft wool, a brooch in the lapel of the coat, a scarf. An old woman walking towards her, or a young woman in the photograph. But none of these images was as real as the face in the bed that night. She wondered how she would remember this, but remembering would be nothing compared to this looking, the intensity of this here and now. The chin ceased to matter. It was a mere detail, and details now were of no consequence. What mattered could not be named or easily seen. If one of the others came into the room, they might not see it at all. It was maybe what she and her mother had been waiting for. She wondered if she had kept away so that this encounter with the body of her mother, with her mother's dead image, could matter more or simply be possible. Her mother's face was both more mask-like and also more individual than it ever had been. Nora would be the only one who would recognize that. None of the others would be able to see it. They were too busy, too close, too involved. It was her distance that made it possible. It was her distance now that allowed her to sleep for a while and then wake with a start in her own room and realize that she had been dreaming, that the night's vigil by her mother's bed was part of a dream. She was in her own house, and it was time to get up and wake the others and make breakfast and go to work.
An extract from the audiobook edition of Nora Webster, which is out now, along with the hardback edition of the book. Colum's memories are extraordinarily clear for those days near 50 years ago. Many people can't place themselves in the past with anything like that precision. But moments of great significance can stand out with sometimes terrible clarity. For Mary Berry, her memories of the day she lost her 19-year-old son remain crisply vivid.
At 10 to 1, Paul arrived home with his friend George, his great mentor in the antiquarian book trade. But as William and Annabel had yet to reappear, they went out into the garden to have a walk round before lunch, while I sat in a pool of sunshine in the morning room and read the papers. It was a lovely spot, but I kept looking at my watch, wondering what was keeping the children, and thinking it was really rather odd that they still weren't back. And then, at 1:20, there was a knock at the door. I opened it to find a policeman standing on the doorstep. And in that moment, I just knew.
"Not good news for you, I'm afraid," said the policeman. He was young, but seemed composed. "There's been an accident. And I have to tell you that William is dead." I don't recall my reaction. I think I went quiet, silenced by the shock of what he had told me. I certainly didn't scream or cry out. I just remember feeling extremely sorry for this young policeman for having to break the news to me. "And Annabel?" I managed to ask. "She's in Wickham Hospital," he replied, but couldn't tell me how badly she was injured. And I just thought, oh no, not two. We went out to find Paul in the garden, and then the policeman drove us to the hospital. As soon as we arrived, someone brought us sweet tea. I never have sugar in tea. I don't even like tea very much. But that particular cup was very comforting. The nurses were so sweet and caring, and their kindness calmed any impulse we might have had to shout or make a scene or argue against the fact of what had happened. We still had no idea what sort of state Annabel was in, and I feared the worst, so we asked to see her, and moments later I heard the sound of running at the end of the long corridor, and then around the corner came this vision in a pink tracksuit, blonde hair flying about everywhere, and although she was a bit scratched and muddy, she was fine. We still had Annabel. That, at least, was something. Annabel went to her father and sat down without saying a word. It was terrible for her. Just terrible. She had just seen her brother die and was clearly deep in shock. Then someone asked us if we would like to see William. And we said that we would. I suppose some people might feel that they wouldn't want to, but there was never any hesitation in my mind. I needed to say goodbye to him. We were shown into a little room that was white and clean and fresh. And there was William, looking absolutely perfect, his body covered by a sheet, with no trauma visible at all. His little face was stone cold, but he looked so beautiful, so lovely. And when I dream of that. He was killed instantly, so we were told. Annabel and I didn't talk about it much, and they wouldn't let me read the newspaper reports in the aftermath. But there, in that little white room, William was perfect. And that's the memory I will always have.
An extract from the audiobook of Mary Berry's autobiography, Recipe for Life, read by Patricia Hodge. And that's available now. Jeremy Paxman's latest book, Great Britain's Great War, explores the years of World War I from the British point of view. But in his introduction, Paxman recounts the story of his uncle Charlie, whose memory has been kept alive, to some extent at least, by his family.
The cigar box. There's a photo on the wall. It was taken, most probably, in the spring of 1915, and shows 8 uniformed men in the jaunty confidence of youth, bedrolls slung across their shoulders. They stand, arms around each other's shoulders, caps askew, one with a cigarette in his mouth, another with a pipe. They smile cheerily. The bright spring sunshine leaves deep shadows on their foreheads. In the middle, arms folded, a young man with a heavy moustache leans on a road sign. Dangerous. Keep off the tar. This is my great-uncle Charlie. He has a Red Cross badge on each shoulder and grins broadly. In his entire military career, Uncle Charlie won no medals for bravery, never advanced beyond the most junior rank in the army, and almost certainly neither killed nor wounded a single German. He had enlisted in the Royal Army Medical Corps, and his job was to save lives, not to take them. The 1911 census records Charles Edmund Dixon as a 20-year-old living in Shipley, working as a weaving overlooker in one of West Yorkshire's numerous textile factories. Uncle Charlie looks a slightly unconvincing soldier, cutting none of the elegant dash of glamorous young officers like Rupert Brooke. He fills the uniform for sure. In fact, he looks as if, with a bit of time, he could more than fill it. On the 7th of August 1915, this bright young Yorkshireman with his affable, cheery face was killed in Turkey. Uncle Charlie's is one of 21,000 names carved around the Helles Memorial, a great stone obelisk at the tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula in Turkey, surrounded by fields of grain nodding in the breeze off the sea, and clearly visible to the boats that run up and down the coast from the Aegean to Istanbul. He was my mother's father's younger brother, dead well before she was born. Yet as children, we were all familiar with him 70 or more years later. Uncle Charlie was a present absence.
Jeremy Paxman reading the introduction to his Great Britain's Great War, which is out now in book form and on audiobook. Now, from the beginning of the First World War to the aftermath of the Second. In his provocative book The Tower, Uwe Tellkamp resurrects the sights, scents and sensations of life in the German Democratic Republic as it hurtled towards the 9th of November 1989. Here he is.
Uwe, can you describe for us your memory of Thursday the 9th of November 1989?
Well, I've been to the military service at that time, as far as I remember, and during my military service time then, in November, I've been a worker in a factory. And in that night, as far as I remember correctly, a rumor spread out throughout the vast halls of that factory, the rumor that the wall is broken down, and nobody believed it. And the master, we call it master of the workers, switched on the television. And showed it to the workers, and they instantly flee from the working places towards Berlin. And I was something like the last passenger of socialism. I was the only man staying there at the factory because I had to be in prison for a fortnight's time, and I was very anxious about re-imprisoned.
Of course.
I didn't dare to went with them. Mm-hmm. So I was the latest only passenger left in this factory of socialism.
Wow. Do you remember how you felt?
Alone.
Yeah. And how was your memory of life during the 7 or so years leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall? How was that altered by writing The Tower, which deals specifically with that period?
I think that my memory of life during these seven years was not really altered by writing The Tower, but the memory came, let's say, into blossom, into life. You have these Japanese flowers there and putting into water, and they will just grow up like this. And it was like the core of an apple. And you put it into blossom, and all those, it's not only the apple, but the whole apple tree.
Mm-hmm. Talking about memory, how important, or rather how beneficial, do you think it is for Germans to remember what life was like before the reunification? Or is it sometimes better to forget?
Well, we have our daily life and we have our remembrances. And as far as I know, and in my daily experience, remembrance doesn't play that great role. But for me, it's important because just being more humble. We forgot a lot of things, the lack of almost everything of daily life. Mm-hmm. The running after the rolls, the bread, even the thread and the needles and so on, all those little rubbish things you couldn't get. And we forgot that. Mm-hmm. And we go to the supermarket and we have the vegetables there and we have the bread, the sorts of breads there. And sometimes I think it's too normal now. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm very eager just to remember and just to get more humble, this humbleness personally. And forgetting, I think, it sometimes is very necessary just to avoid revenge.
Yeah, and to move on.
And to move on, mm-hmm. look forward. Mm-hmm. You can't live in the past. You can't go home again. This is a title of a novel by Thomas Wolfe. You mm-hmm. can't go home again. Mm-hmm. Just to avoid revenge and to look forward.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's necessary.
Uwe Telkamp, talking about his book The Tower, and it's available now. You're listening to the Penguin Podcast. Now, how many poems can you recite from memory? One or two? A handful, maybe? Well, it's becoming something of a school revolution, thanks to former Poet Laureate Andrew Motion, who has devised Poetry by Heart, a nationwide annual competition for secondary schools, asking contestants to learn two or three poems and be judged on their recitations. Coinciding with the start of its third year, an anthology of 200 poems compiled by Motion and his three co-editors has been published, offering a treasure house of poems with a view to their being recited out loud. Here's Andrew Motion.
First of all, Andrew, can I ask you about the genesis of this anthology, Poetry by Heart? It comes out of a competition that you thought of and is now up and running?
It does come out of a competition, and before coming out of the competition, it comes out of something that I set up when I, or helped to set up, I should say, when I was being Poet Laureate, which is the Poetry Archive that's, as many people listening to this will already know, is a website that exists to preserve, promote, generally sort of make available, with quite a lot of editorial copies surrounding it, recordings of poets reading their own work. So essentially it's an archive which is to do with sound, which is based on the very simple but powerful idea that wherever we reckon the meaning of a poem might reside, or the meanings might reside, we have to admit that it has as much to do with the noise the poem makes as it does to do with what the words mean when we see them written down on the page, both in terms of the sense on the page and the patterns they make on the page. In other words, I'm very interested, manifestly interested in the acoustic world of poetry. The archive's now been up and running for 10 and more years. And when the present government was elected, because some of our previous funding has come from departments of education under the old Labour regime, when the new government was elected, I thought that I would go and talk to the new, recently arrived people in the Department of Education to see whether they wanted to support us too. And of course, they said that there wasn't any money, but they also, in the conversation that followed that, and I'm talking in particular here about a person called Nick Gibb, who was the minister in the department then, but later got reshuffled. As the conversation developed, it led to us talking a bit about hearing poems aloud and the value of that. And he said to me, why don't you set up a competition for this? Because I'd indicated that had I then still been laureate, I might have wanted to do that. And I said, well, look, I've just given up doing all this stuff and I want my life back. But as I walked away from that meeting, I thought, actually, you never get asked that kind of thing twice. And if I really think it's a good idea, then I'd better go for it. So my colleague at the archive, our education director at the archive, Julie Blake, and I wrote for the department a feasibility study about how such a competition might run, taking quite a lot of our structural ideas from the equivalent American competition that's been running for a good while over there and very successfully with an enormous take-up and with already quite a well-defined place in the life of the education calendar and indeed of the national calendar.
Like a spelling bee.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, the Americans do that kind of thing incredibly well. They make it welcome in a very heartening kind of way.
Curious, given it's such a big country, you'd think it would be
very interesting.
Here,
perhaps they rise to that challenge. Always see the challenge and then rise to it. But precisely, I mean, you'd think that, given the comparative smallness of England, because this is only an England-wide competition,
right?
Because the remit of our Department for Education doesn't extend beyond that. You'd think that would be quite easy to organise. Anyway. So they liked the look of the feasibility study. One thing led to another with a bit of heaving and toing and froing and so forth. So we launched the first competition 2 and a bit years ago. Well, I suppose, strictly speaking, we launched it 3 years ago and then spent the first of those years sort of collecting schools to take part in it. But the first, we've had two competitions run so far, and we're now right at the beginning of the third year of it, still funded by the Department for Education, but with a very significant increase in the take-up of schools through those 3 years. We're only a month and a bit into the third version of it, and already our registration figures are massively up on the two previous years.
Fantastic.
So that's all looking very good.
And this is specifically secondary schools. There's an age...
It's secondary schools. Yes, the way it works is that it's only for secondary schools. It'd be wonderful to think down the track that we might do a similar sort of thing for primary schools as well. Wouldn't be very difficult to do in a sort of tandem operation. You need money to do it, but it would be eminently doable. We decided very early on that rather than let the students choose their own poems, we would choose a pool of poems from which they could make their selection. And the reason for that is not to be controlling, though I can see that some people might think that as they first encounter that idea, but rather the opposite, because we thought that if we did leave students to choose their own things, they would almost inevitably, and in some ways perfectly understandably, choose poems which they already knew, more or less, and or, which might be the same thing, poems that they were studying for their exams. And it was very much part of our intention for the competition that it would extend that there'd be a lot of collateral benefits, actually, and that one of them would be an extension of the kind of reading that students might feel entitled to within the schools. I think it's sadly very often the case, and again for understandable reasons, that a lot of pupils stick within the tram lines or on the tram lines of the reading that they have to do to get their grades. So if there's a sort of benevolent and exciting way of extending their reading experience, then why not do that?
It's a very wide range of authors, isn't it? I mean, it goes from, as it were, Beowulf to Andrew Meshkov.
Well, to now. Yes, it's arranged chronologically. Yeah. Some of the poems were written hundreds and hundreds of years ago, Beowulf exactly being the earliest one in the book, and some of them were written within the last year or so. So it goes right the way across the board. No poet is allowed to have more than one poem in the book, which again was decided upon for reasons of diversity. The shortest are sonnets, so 14 lines. The longest are a couple of pages or so. Very interestingly, and I thought wonderfully, and certainly very movingly, in the first finals that we held, first two finals were held in the National Portrait Gallery here in London, where you and I are talking to each other. The young woman who won it, who was at a sixth form college in Nottinghamshire, chose as her early poem a passage from Gawain and the Green Knight, which she recited in Middle English. She taught herself Middle English to learn how to do this.
I've heard her do that, and it is quite extraordinary.
It's mind-blowing. Yeah. I mean, anybody who's struck by that should go to the Poetry by Heart website and listen to her doing it, because it's loaded up there. And as her more recent poem, she chose one of the longest poems in the book, which was a beautiful, thin, but still long poem by Elizabeth Bishop called The Fish, which he also did very subtly and well.
Yeah. So the students have to choose one older poem. What's that mean, pre-1900?
Pre-1914. We thought that 1914, and not just because we're thinking about 1914 this year, would be a sort of decisive turning point between, I mean, thinking very crudely about this, between yesterday and today, ancient and modern, pre-modernist and modernist and thereafter, which, because all the poems on the website version of the anthology, you have pictures accompanying them, pictures of their authors accompanying them, also turns out to be more or less the moment where various significant changes happen. One is that a lot of women suddenly start to show up on the radar, yeah. And also that facial hair takes a bit of a...
beard's gay. Yes, absolutely. It's fascinating. It must be fascinating to see what people choose. I mean, this is perhaps putting you on the spot, but did anything surprise you? I mean, were there some poets that were
very much
overly represented, overly chosen, and some that weren't?
A few were chosen by conspicuously large numbers of people, but in a sense, quite surprising ones, until you've heard them a few times when you think, actually, the surprise is rather worn off. So Oscar Wilde's Ballad of Reading Gaol, for instance, has turned up a lot.
Has it? Yeah.
There's quite a big chunk of the Ballad of Reading Gaol.
Relatively easy to learn. I mean, I'm sure nothing's easy to learn, but relatively easy.
Easier, of course, always for children, because by the time you get to your age and mine, synapses are beginning to collapse. Or at least I should speak for myself. Mine certainly are. And I find it much harder to learn things by heart now than I did when I was a child. I mean, children, by and large, sponge things out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Andrew Motion talking about poetry by heart. I wonder if limericks count. A habit obscene and unsavoury? Maybe not. And that's it from the Penguin Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes for future podcast episodes and head to SoundCloud for other author readings and audiobook extracts at www.soundcloud.com/penguin-books. To find out more about the authors and books featured in this episode, visit the website thepenguinpodcast.co.uk, and if you have any comments or suggestions, you can email them to podcast@uk.penguingroup.com or find us on Twitter @PenguinAudio using the hashtag PenguinPodcast.
You've been listening to The Penguin Podcast.